He says Venezuela has tremendous oil. Venezuela has always had tremendous oil. And why now? Why is the U.S. acting now?
As part of this reframing, reimagining what the U.S. is, and he's explicit about it. He's talking about the Monroe Doctrine. He says, no, it's even bigger and better than the Monroe Doctrine. It's the Donroe Doctrine. And what is it?
It
basically says, exactly. And what it is saying, all of the Americas is ours. We reserve the prerogatives of an imperial overlord. If we don't like who you elected in Guatemala, in Chile, in Brazil, anywhere, we reserve the right to intervene. We can invade you, we can bomb you, we can send the CIA in to stage a coup, etc., because this is our sphere of influence.
Hello everyone, Happy New Year, welcome to 2026, and I'm sorry I've got this little thingy on my head. You're just going to have to put up with that. DC is just very cold, but DC is also quite crazy. I don't even know what to call this episode of the Readiness Report. Everyone I've been speaking to, what's happening? How far is this going to go? Is it oil, power, and kidnapping presidents? Is that what we call it? Venezuela, and just the return to gunboat diplomacy. That's what I would call it. Welcome, anyway, to the Readiness Report. You know, I was just thinking about this in the last couple of days, that in 1953, and my guest can correct me if I'm wrong, the CIA helped overthrow Iran's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. And depending on which history books you read, some would argue that his crime was to nationalize oil, right? And then fast forward, 1961, the United States crushed Cuba's revolution at the Bay of Pigs. And again, depending on which history books you read, you'll get whatever it is that you want to get. 1973, Chile's Salvador Allende was removed violently, and history books, some will say that he dared to chart an independent economic path. Different decades, different continents, different interpretations, but it is the same old script. Regardless of the makeup or unpalatability of a particular leader of a sovereign state, does the United States have a God-given right to ignore the UN, to ignore international law, and just storm in to kidnap that country's government and essentially that country's president and essentially overthrow its government? Do countries don't have the mechanisms domestically to deal with whatever issue that citizens may have? Can citizens be supported in different ways other than this brazen storming in and kidnapping a president? The United States launched what it calls a limited, right? That's the word they're using, limited military operation in Venezuela, an invasion followed by forcible seizure and removal of President Nicolas Maduro, whom I'm told at this moment is going to be removed from Brooklyn, I think, to Manhattan, or is it the other way around? Anyway, some part of New York, in order to make his first court appearance at 12 midday EST. This is on Monday. If you ask me, a kidnapping by any other name, Washington insists that this is about democracy, about drug trafficking, about national security. But here's the funny thing. Donald Trump always says the quiet part loud, right? And I am quoting him here verbatim. He said that this is about oil. Venezuela has tremendous oil. So that's what it's about. No pretense, no poetry, just extraction, raw and vanished. So today we ask, are we returning to regime change as the official U.S. policy? Are we in this era of extractive, predatory foreign policy practices by the United States? Tony Caron is no stranger to the Readiness Report. He's a colleague at Al Jazeera, a senior editor there, and you can follow his own output on these global affairs. Tony, welcome. I mean, that's where we start. What's going on?
Well, in your history there, you didn't mention Africa. Now, what about Patrice Lumumba? What about Kwame Nkrumah? What about Gaddafi? They have a long history of just taking out people they don't like and leaving chaos. in their way, because that's it. Very, very rarely, no matter how odious the regime that they take out. I mean, remember Saddam Hussein? Nobody liked Saddam Hussein, but they didn't want to be liberated by the United States, because look what happens when that happens. There's no plan. There's no, you know, no country, no people accepts being told, being colonized, being told by a Western, any outside power, here's how you will be governed, and here's what's going to happen to your resources. That's exactly what the U.S. is doing now. By the way, I don't think Mossadegh actually nationalized the oil industry at all. And those of you who are interested in accountability, go and read Kojo Koram's Uncommon Wealth. He has a fantastic chapter blaming BP for the Iranian revolution in 79, because BP used to, whatever it was called then, used to extract the oil and pay nothing to the Iranians. And he tried to put a tax. Oh, okay, BP can pump the oil, but they'll pay 20% to the Iranian government and tax, you know, for an Iranian resource. And they were like, nah, we got to get rid of this guy. And they did.
Carry on, Tony.
I was just going to say, this is the big picture here is that the United States that we knew in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, and maybe the first couple of decades of the 21st, is gone. There is no more, like, the Cold War sensibility that had the U.S. acting, you know, in the name of democracy and all this stuff, even though it was plainly not, because it was actually imposing dictators more often than bringing democracy. But all of that pretense that the U.S. acts for the greater good of everyone against this imagined Soviet threat, that's all out of the window. And even domestically, you know, a lot of the liberal consensus in the United States in the post-war years, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, etc., those things were all Cold War consensus points. And now that the Cold War is over, they're kind of reversing them. So I think get used to the idea that the United States actually is more like what it was 120 years ago in the time of Teddy Roosevelt, where you just take stuff. You just, like, you have manifest destiny. You go and grab Hawaii. You go and grab Puerto Rico. You go and grab the Philippines. Grab things you think you need, well, that you want for
Greenland,
resources and power.
Talking about Greenland as well. I mean, so look, the administration has offered multiple justification: drug trafficking, restoring democracy, regional security, but they contradict each other and often they collapse under minimal scrutiny. But here's the thing with Donald Trump. He just cuts through the fog, isn't it? He says Venezuela has tremendous oil. Venezuela has always had tremendous oil. And why now? Why is the U.S. acting now?
So as part of this reframing, reimagining what the U.S. is, and he's explicit about it, he's talking about the Monroe Doctrine, the Roosevelt, whatever they called it. He says, no, it's even bigger and better than the Monroe Doctrine. It's the Donroe Doctrine. And
he
what
called
is
it? Donroe
it basically
Doctrine,
says...
Yeah?
Exactly. And what it is saying all of the Americas is ours. We reserve the prerogatives of an imperial overlord. If we don't like who you elected in Guatemala, in Chile, in Brazil, anywhere, we reserve the right to intervene. We can invade you, we can bomb you, we can send the CIA in to stage a coup, etc., because this is our sphere of influence. Now, that had been, you know, obviously, that's completely contemptuous of anybody's sovereignty, anybody's right to self-determination. It's like, no, we will tell you what's up. And, you know, that went out of fashion. You know, maybe it was contested in the Cold War by, you know, Cuba, by revolutions elsewhere in Latin America, by elections elsewhere in Latin America. By the end of the Cold War, it was like, okay, we're going to do things differently. We're going to recognize the sovereignty of all of these states. The Organization of American States doesn't accept coups and overthrows and it's all gone. Now we're going back to what we want and we will take it because nobody's going to stand in our way.
Yeah.
So in terms of why now, and look, this thing about oil, it's true. That's exactly, you know, that's what he's saying. But it's not going, like, Venezuela's oil fields are not going to yield anything to the United States for the next 10 years. It's going to, all the industry analysts say, it's going to take at least that long to revive that that industry and sort of turn it into like a money spinner in the way that he's saying. So this is also a message like, hey, if you read our national security doctrine, you read that basically we are prioritizing reestablishing American control in all of the Americas, U.S. control in all of the Americas. And this is like a first shot over the bows. Cuba, we are coming for you. Colombia, you better get on site. Mexico, we're coming, you know, hey, we can't accept you. You know, we don't accept you. Like, you're telling us we can't invade your country to go after narcos, etc. It's like, you know, this is cracking the whip, basically.
And this is where it becomes existential, right? It's becoming existential for smaller states. I mean, you mentioned a couple of countries. We spoke about the energy politics, that we can't separate this from the energy politics, from U.S. corporate interests, and from the strategic desire to control supply in an unstable global energy market. But that's not all that we are seeing. You mentioned like the revival of a 20th century doctrine. Resources justify intervention, but also size, isn't it? It's not just if your country is rich but not compliant, whatever compliance means, you are vulnerable. Smaller states are just vulnerable. What does this mean? What does it do to the global order?
So there's, two thoughts there. The one thing to notice, and some people say this, like, you know, Trump is doing Monroe Doctrine and so on, but he's doing his kind of players one on TV thing. Like, if you think about substantially what's just happened in Venezuela, it's in line with the U.S. Okay, here's the key point I want to make. Trump does not put U.S. troops in harm's way. He does not actually put boots on the ground because they might get shot at. So he takes military action in ways that are very made for TV, but there's very little chance of being shot back at. I mean, it looks like there was some sort of arrangement here. There's very little resistance to what the U.S. did. It seems that some people in Maduro circles probably gave him up or, you know, enabled this, betrayed him, were happy to get rid of him. It seems to have been a conversation with his vice president that was ongoing because that just snapped into place. But if you think about it, the U.S. has been backing the opposition, claiming they are the legitimately elected government. And Trump's like, nah, they don't have enough respect. We are going to basically go with the current regime doing what we tell them to do or else. That's going to be the model. Because if you didn't do that, you would then have to send in troops to back a new government that's opposed by the military, that's opposed by many armed people in Venezuela. So it's much easier to do it this way. So it's a weird style of you know, waging war from a safe distance. So you can wreck things with missiles and bombs and all this stuff, but you can't go in and actually, you don't want to go in and occupy places because then your people are going to get shot at. And he can't, that's his sort of no more forever wars thing. So that's on the one side. On the other side, you know, on that one point. So this is very much a 21st century model. The other thing is basically, I think the message is clear. Like if you're Denmark, you're a NATO member, and he's saying, you know what? Sorry, your sovereignty doesn't count. I'm coming for your island of Greenland. Like, so what does that do? I mean, it's a message to all of the world. It's very reckless because he's antagonizing everybody at the same time. He's not just antagonizing Cuba and you know, places that are known to resist the United States. He's antagonizing allies. You know, the thing is like, oh, he's going after China. But he's also antagonizing India, which is China's biggest rival. It's like, this is completely reckless. You're actually giving everyone an incentive to basically... strange bedfellows to work together to kind of create alternatives to U.S. power that put some restraint on it.
But that also disturbs me then, because if he is indeed antagonizing everybody, I would have expected some heat in the responses that we saw from the EU to the African Union and individual European states like France and so on, except for Spain, I think, Canada around the corner here. The responses were so benign. You know, it was not commensurate with the gravity of the situation. If he's antagonizing everybody, why are they not drawing the line? There was no consensus. There was no UN mandate. South Africa issued a statement calling for an urgent sitting of the UN. But generally, they are responding as if they're like, you know, high five, bro, you did something that we don't have the guts to do, or we're just going to reiterate the importance of international law, but just look the other way. Some of these statements don't even mention the United States. It's as if this act of aggression just fell like manna from heaven, and no, there's no protagonist behind it. Your thoughts on the global reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, if you think about the way that those Western powers in particular have been prepared to completely look the other way and abandon any idea of international law, international norms, humanitarian law, etc., when it comes to Israel and the genocide in Gaza. And it's like, oh, wait, okay, no, yeah, the U.S. is now ignoring ignoring international law has become a norm, which they don't react to. I suspect that a lot of them are still clinging to this idea, you know, you sometimes hear it here in South Africa, of sort of more conservative, you know, parties going, we need to get back on side with the United States. We need to be nice to them and give them what they want. Otherwise, you know, we'll be in trouble. It's like, they're not recognizing what's actually happening, because it's scary to recognize that. It's scary to recognize that if you want to protect your sovereignty, the United States is not your ally. If you want to protect any kind of international law, the United States is not your ally. Even trade law, I mean, the thing they care most about, because we know that it's all, at the end of the day, a lot of these Western countries are ruled by business interests. So now being, you know, challenged by Trump, but they basically trapsachtig when it comes to dealing with the U.S. I think that might last for a while, but I don't think it's sustainable, because basically this is, you know, it's like, it's just like this thing exploded and it's kind of just coming, you know, every which way. And where are they going to draw the line, obviously, and how are they going to draw the line? Nobody has the military capacity to resist the U.S. That's absolutely clear. At the same time, there's a limit to what the U.S. is prepared to put on the table militarily. Like, would Trump go to war if China decided to reclaim Taiwan? But no, I wouldn't bet on it. It's such an interesting mix of this really belligerent saber rattling on TV. I'm the boss of everyone, the boss of everything. I will crush you like a bug.
And but he's actually, saying it. Pence, Rubio, they're saying.
But also, in a weird way, being a little cautious about what they do. Remember when they bombed Iran, like last year? I can't remember. It's all a blur now. They bombed Iran once when the Israelis had knocked out all the air defenses. So it was completely safe. When they flew over once and they dropped a whole lot of bombs, and Trump was like, that's done, move on. And it's like, well, it's obviously not done, because they're talking about, you know, Israel might attack Iran again. But it's like this idea that you create these things for TV that look like you've. And I mean, what exactly is the reality?
Finish that thought, yeah?
No, it's like, what exactly is happening in Venezuela right now? Nobody really knows, because it's not like they've taken out the old regime and put in a new one, or put in Americans. You know, they'll say Marco Rubio and Pete Hegseth are going to run Venezuela. But no, what is happening right now is the Maduro regime without Maduro is in charge. So there's nothing's actually changed.
Yeah. And I mean, the opposition, it was so absurd, actually, because if the argument is that Maduro is not a legitimate leader, he stole the election, it should then mean that the opposition is the legitimate one. But he's just thrown the opposition under the bus. That woman who got the Nobel Prize, I don't even want to say her name.
Machado.
Yeah. And I mean, Donald Trump said she doesn't enjoy any respect or popularity in Venezuela. So if she won the election, what do you mean then she doesn't enjoy respect and popularity? And she's been twerking.
What does Trump mean by respect?
Yeah, she's been
twerking. Who does Trump respect? He respects strong men. Mm-hmm. He respects people who can act violently to impose their will. Yeah. So he's saying basically, Machado doesn't have an army and I'm not going to give her mine. Yeah. So better to go with the current regime that has an army, because let's see if we can force them to do what we want them to do under threat of more violence. So it's a kind of strange one. Yes, this is not about democracy. Frankly, it's never been about democracy. I mean, if you just look at the track record of who the US overthrew in the 20th century in the name of democracy and what followed, it's like, no, that, you know, the Western side of the Cold War equation wasn't about democracy. That's just sort of some branding language you put on the tin or on the tank.
Yeah. I mean, at times like these, we are right to ask, what is the point of the United Nations? What does it mean for multilateralism? I woke up to a statement or some comment from Marco Rubio saying the UN doesn't know what it's doing. So they have literally emasculated the United Nations. Are we here where regime change is now official policy without apology? And the world is just becoming more dangerous and there's no deterrence at all. Thoughts on the United Nations?
Well, the United Nations is never anything more than the sum of its parts. So you just have to look what the part. The United Nations can't act independently of its member states. So it's just the combination of those member states. The United States is far more powerful than any other. Its army is bigger than like the next 20 countries combined. I don't know if that's still accurate, but something like that. And then none of these countries, you know, you think about China. China is the strongest country, you know, economically in the world outside of the United States, and militarily maybe getting there. But does China want to compete with the United States for military power around the world? Like, no, it's only got the only military base outside of its absolute neighborhood is Djibouti. And that was because of shipping lanes. And everybody has a base in Djibouti, by the way. It must be quite interesting going to a bar in Djibouti, because you can imagine the bar fights might have geopolitical consequences. But, seriously speaking, nobody else is seeking global domination, seeking to control the Americas, seeking to control Africa. China has an economic interest in a lot of those places. But that's China's power. It's economic. It's not military. So it's going to probably take years for people, these other countries, to figure out how do they restrain the U.S. But at the same time, the U.S. is kind of running on empty. It can break a whole lot of things. But look what happened in Iraq. Look what happened in Afghanistan. They can't build anything that's sustainable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and even now, they've learned that lesson. So now they elect presidents who say, we're not going to do that. Literally, Obama wins the 2008 nomination from Hillary by running against the Iraq war. Mm. And Trump wins the 2016 nomination from Jeb Bush by running against the Iraq war. It's like Americans don't want their sons and daughters going off to foreign wars. Mm. So that, you know, there's a conundrum there. Can you do this all by remote? You can do a lot of damage by remote, but at the end of the day, you're going to create chaos. Like, if there's chaos in Venezuela, how are those American oil companies going to invest in what Trump wants them to do?
I mean,
if it's unstable.
You've clearly said, history teaches us something brutal here. Regime change doesn't bring stability, it brings chaos, blowback, and decades of reckoning. Iran, Iraq, Chile, to Libya. So how is this going to play out domestically? So he's doing it remotely, but the narrative on the ground is that you promised no more wars. My impression is that Americans are not seeing it in that way, that we're doing it remotely, therefore it is okay. The reaction has been quite robust and has been strong. Obviously, those who support him are supporting him, but even within the GOP or MAGA, the chasm, the cracks are beginning to show. And their understanding of this is that Trump is starting wars that have an impact on their sons and daughters, to use your term. Is this likely to result in some repercussions domestically, especially as we go into the midterms in November?
I think probably not. I think because basically what it took for that to happen, whether it was Vietnam or whether it was Iraq, it took a lot of Americans coming home in body bags. And a lot of very ordinary white Americans who would vote for like whatever government had started the war to go, wait a minute, like my neighbor's kid died. Like for what? Like why did all these kids he knew from high school die or have to go off or lose their limbs? Or it's very much like how it affects them. It's not a moral question and so on. And then also remember, Trump is giving them the TV shows. Like, look how great America is. Like, we did all this great stuff. Remember, Reagan did that. Like, I mean, I actually remember sitting in South Africa in 1983 with like ANC comrades going, watching the Grenada invasion. We were like, oh gosh. Like, if we ever manage to overthrow the apartheid regime in South Africa, we should expect the 82nd Airborne to come flying in, you know, a minute later, because they like, you know, doing this kind of thing. But I think now it's like Trump's giving them a light show, and it's low cost. It's low cost. It's kind of, if America's not hurting as a result of its foreign wars, then I don't think it's going to register. I also don't think the midterms really change the equation, even if the Democrats win. I think so much, none of this stuff is legislated. You know, they can put him up in congressional inquiries or whatever. And, you know, he can spit on them, which he does. He's like, I'm going to do this. Like,
it's almost as if he's daring them, when he first ran.
Yeah, he doesn't take them seriously, I think, in some ways. Like, remember in when he first ran in 2016 and he said, you know, I could shoot someone dead in Fifth Avenue and wouldn't change my prospects. Like, so, yeah, I mean, look, we can agree that what his main reason he got elected was the economy. And he can't deliver on what he promised. The tariffs are not going to make Americans'
rich
economic condition any better. They're going to make it worse. So, and you don't have to be a free marketeer, whatever, to believe that. But it's just like, look at what's happening in, you know, the people in America who voted for him, the, you know, not only the sort of white, more working class, but also like the Latino working class, the black working class, people who voted for Trump because they actually thought he might do better because Biden's economics wasn't doing anything for them anyway. And he's not delivering on that. And it's almost interesting is the more those numbers start coming in, the more he's like making war and foreign policy and, creating other distractions. Thatcher did that in 1984 with the Falklands, Malvinas.
Okay, we could speak about this until the cows come home. Let's pause for the moment. Don't be surprised if you get another call from me if Donald Trump does something in the next 24 hours. But as always, appreciate your insights. And I'm so jealous that you are where you are and I am where I am. So.
Yeah. Until the cars come home.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you. That's the Readiness Report, folks. What a crazy world. What a crazy time. Thanks for tuning in.
This episode was brought to you by the Friedrich Naumann Foundation.